Save big money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get your project started right with our huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, from installing a walkway to setting a post. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius John Batchelor. I welcome Germanicus Marcovlejos. Londinium, a rainy afternoon in high summer. The Thames is rocky. I wouldn't want to cross it right now. The bridge is splashed. However, we're on the north side of the Thames. Quite comfortable. Cup of wine, surrounded by shoppers, the consumers of the first century AD. It's 91 AD. And we're looking at the results in the 21st century of the gathering of eagles, the meeting of the NATO chiefs in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, to entertain the proposal that Ukraine, at war with the Russian Federation, be immediately embraced by NATO. And all that means, immediately, that was much the demand, suggestion, assertion of President Zelensky of Ukraine and some other voices. The result of this campaign is unclear, which is why I invite Germanicus to comment. There were some facts established. One, the President of the United States announced that after much consideration, cluster munitions would be available to the Ukrainian forces. This is a form of artillery called Iron Rain when it was used in the Gulf Wars, in which small, like bomblets, are fired into the air by the same weapons that fire large shells, 155 shells, and rain down on troops that are in positions you can identify, such as trenches or cities. They're standoff weapons. Also debated was the F-16, not yet, and the ATACMS, not yet, and long-range missiles, not yet. So much of the result from the NATO meeting, to read from the headlines, was about hardware and not about resolution. Germanicus, a very good evening to you. What do you take from the NATO meeting? What was resolved in some fashion that won't change again in a few days? Good evening to you.
Good evening, Gaius. The NATO summit is best characterized now in retrospect as a sort of grand theater, or even a grand opera, if you will, although its aesthetic content doesn't rise to that level. It was essentially a ceremonial convocation in which NATO, and by NATO I mean really the American Empire, and by the American Empire I mean really the will of the empire, emperor and his circle of courtiers. It was an opportunity to delineate, make clear what the U.S. was going to do about Ukraine, what its objectives would be moving forward, and what the U.S.-NATO relationship would be with Ukraine also moving forward. So it was essential as the first part of this opera to make it clear that the NATO relationship with Ukraine and Mr. Zelensky was simply one of reestablishing his proxy status as a client king, as it were, and therefore to underscore that he was not to imagine that Ukraine would ever become a part of NATO, at least while the war was ongoing, and that his job was to continue to usefully sacrifice his nation for the purposes and objectives of the NATO alliance, and ultimately, of course, American empire. And this was made quite clear. Also, it was necessary for the U.S. to establish that this was not going to be a war whose outcome had been so prematurely and so long enunciated as a complete Ukrainian victory and the humbling of Russia and bringing Mr. Putin and his regime to its knees, because things had changed. They changed on the ground. They changed in the larger dynamics of the war. And so it was necessary to find a way to present an altered situation in Ukraine, one in which Ukraine should be grateful that the U.S. and NATO are still supporting it. Hence the statements by various British cabinet officials about how Mr. Zelensky should show a little more gratitude, for example, even though, of course, the Ukrainians are the ones who are being used by us as changelings for our goals against Russia, and they're the ones who are bleeding out. But it was essential to establish both the subordinate position of Ukraine and the fact that we were no longer pretending that the Ukrainian war would end in an ecstatic victory for Ukraine and the forces of democracy. Therefore, the presentation was one of a long, long struggle against the forces of evil, in which Ukraine would continue to perform the role that we had chosen for it. And finally, and this is the most interesting aspect in some ways, is that a fantasy narrative of imminent Ukrainian victory had to be transformed into one of gritty attrition. And this has been to some extent performed in the last several days by a major article in the New York Times, in which the high expectations long trumpeted of an imminent victorious offensive have been exchanged for the bleaker but still heroic, gritty Ukrainian attrition war with Russia, and how this is essentially the way it has to be. And Ukraine can still outperform Russia and still do great things, and Russia is still ever weakening and ever demoralized. But the main element of this is the poverty of Western arsenals to continue to supply Ukraine. I mean, the U.S. may be hallowed in historical lore as the arsenal of democracy, but its cupboard is bare. And the admission, the confession made by the American emperor himself when Mr. Biden admitted that we were running out of traditional unitary munitions for artillery, that we had to give in lieu of the kind of effective munitions that Ukraine needs or any army needs against a modern opponent, we're going to give them a kind of boutique munition that had become essentially obsolete and had been stored away in large numbers. So we have plenty of shells to give Ukraine, but they're not tremendously effective in terms of what Ukraine needs to do. And yet that's all we have. So we're giving God only knows how many of these cluster munitions to Ukraine. And this is announced at the same time that we announce a kind of rather threadbare tranche of further equipment and weapons for Ukraine, which does not include F-16s, because it's been discovered that F-16s are going to be at a profound disadvantage in theater if they're ever delivered. They're going to be naked on Ukrainian runways. They cannot operate on rough airstrips like Russian aircraft can. And as a result, they'll be exposed, and in the air, they'll be outfought both by superior Russian interceptor fighter aircraft, and above all, by a rather extraordinarily capable Russian air defense, which can knock a jet out of the sky at a range of scores or even hundreds of miles. So we're withholding And what we're giving is a sort of a mild slap in the face. And so if you take all of this together as a package, what NATO and the U.S. have done above all is to redefine the war as a war that will continue to serve the needs of the president, the emperor, and his administration as it heads into a reelection campaign. And the war provides the dispensation in such a domestic political context of continuing to promote the higher authority of the president, to rally Americans around the patriotic ideal that is contained in the war, even though the war is itself a cynical exercise and enterprise. Nonetheless, the war has become necessary to the Biden administration because it provides cover. It supports the president in terms of the authority of a foreign war against the erosion of authority that's occurring within the U.S. itself. So,
Germanicus, I want to read you a statement because your remarks are going to what is the future and why it's sustained. I want to read you a statement from an article from the Foreign Affairs, Ukraine Should Aim for Victory, Not Compromise, by Alina Polyakova and Daniel Fried. And your comment is welcome. A military stalemate is indeed possible. At some point, negotiations with Russia will be needed to end this war. But Ukraine should start negotiating only when it is in the strongest possible position. It should not be rushed into talks when Russia shows no interest in any settlement terms other than Ukraine's surrender. Starting negotiations now would mean accepting Putin's maximalist terms. If Russia suffers further setbacks on the battlefield, talks could proceed from a better starting place. The most important point, which Ukraine's allies agree on, is that Ukraine must define the right moment for negotiations. That may or may not be when all of Ukraine's territory is liberated. The key is for Ukraine to maintain flexibility in its decisions about its territory and the path toward a just peace. Now, having read that out loud, it occurs to me that I have no idea what the time frame here is. I think it's indefinite. Should. How do you hear this, Germanicus? It sounded almost a fatalist.
It is fatalist and it is indefinite, but in practical terms, it is an extension of the war at least until after the 2024 election. And the statement is on the surface fatuous and disingenuous because everyone knows that Mr. Zelensky is a client, a subordinate vassal client of the United States and has no free will or agency at all, completely dependent for everything, including pension remittances on the U.S. Treasury. And so the U.S. is deciding to transform this war from a war that could, it was hoped, lead to victory to a war that will simply be continued on life support and cannot at any, under any eventuality, be ended, and certainly not through a negotiation. Negotiation at this point in the war would lead to the impression of a U.S.-NATO defeat, and it would completely undercut the Biden administration, especially in terms of its reelection chances, or at least Blue's reelection chances. So it's necessary to keep this war on life support. Hence, we will give Ukraine enough weapons so that it somehow staggers on, bleeding out at least through the 2024 election.
Michael Vlahos is Germanicus. I am Gaius, John Batchelor. We're philosophizing about the 21st century here in the first century AD, where things are quite cozy in the summertime. We're far away from Rome. No intrigue around here that we know of. Of course, the walls have ears, right, Germanicus? And at the same time, we're surrounded by healthy centurions, all retired with their families, shopping in Londinium on a rainy day. Rome is so far away. When we come back, we're going to address something I've learned recently about the 17th century, another landscape that Germanicus and I enjoy debating, because as the American 20th and 21st century derive their institutions, their opinions, their attitudes, their stubbornness from the first century AD Rome, so did the 17th century, although far more skilled in Latin because it was drilled into them as schoolboys. When we come back, the English Revolution, 1603 to 1689, and a surprise revelation to me. I'll check with Germanicus. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.